And in answer, Levine went back to his tapes. Here's a reenactment of another of the videos Levine showed me. It's of a young woman, let's call her Sally. The interviewer walked her through the straightforward questions without incident. Then came the crucial moment.
Now, did any cheating occur when Rachel left the room?
No.
Are you telling me the truth?
Yeah.
So when I interview your partner, I'm going to ask her the same question. What is she going to say?
Sally pauses, looks uncertain.
Probably the same answer.
Okay.
The moment the interviewer asks the question, did any cheating occur? Sally's arms and face begin to turn a bright red. Calling it an embarrassed blush doesn't quite do it justice. Sally gives a whole new meaning to the expression, caught red-handed. Then comes the critical question. What will your partner say? Blushing Sally can't even come up with a convincing, she'll agree with me. She hems and haws and says weakly, probably same answer? Probably? Blushing Sally is lying, and everyone called in to judge the tape realizes she's lying. Here's the next tape Levine showed me. It's of a woman who spent the entire interview obsessively playing with her hair. Let's call her Nervous Nellie.
Now, Rachel had to get called out of the room. Did any cheating occur when she was gone?
Actually, my partner did want to look at the scores, and I said no. Was like, I want to see how many we got right, because I don't cheat. I think it's wrong, so I didn't. I told her no. I was like, I don't want to do that. But she did say, well, we'll just look at one. I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I didn't know if it was part of it or not, but no, we didn't do that.
Okay. So, are you telling me the truth about the cheating?
Yeah, we didn't. She wanted, my partner honestly said, we'll just look at one. I was like, no, that's not cool. I don't want to do that. The only thing I said was, I'm surprised they left all the money in here. I honestly don't steal or cheat. I'm a good person like that. I was just kind of surprised because normally when people leave money behind, you're going to take it. That's just what everybody does. But no, we didn't cheat. We didn't steal anything.
Nervous Nellie never stops twirling her hair, nor does she stop the halting, overly defensive, repetitive explanations, nor the fidgeting and the low-level agitation.
Okay. So when I call on your partner for an interview, what is she going to say to that question?
I think she'll say that she wanted to look.
Okay.
If she says otherwise, that's not cool at all, because I said, no, I don't want to cheat at all. She just said, why not just look at one? She said, well, the answers are right there. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. That's not who I am. It's not what I do.
I was convinced Nervous Nellie was lying. You would conclude the same if you saw her in action. Everybody thought Nervous Nellie was lying, but she wasn't. When her partner reported back to Levine, he confirmed everything Nervous Nellie said. Levine found this pattern again and again. In one experiment, for instance, there was a group of interviewees whom 80% of the judges got wrong, and another group whom more than 80% got right. So what's the explanation? Levine argues that this is the assumption of transparency in action. We tend to judge people's honesty based on their demeanor. Well-spoken, confident people with a firm handshake, those who are friendly and engaging, are seen as believable. Nervous, shifty, stammering, uncomfortable people who give windy, convoluted explanations are not seen as believable. In a survey of attitudes towards deception conducted a few years ago, which involved thousands of people in 58 countries around the world, 63% of those asked said the cue they most used to spot a liar was gaze aversion. We think liars in real life behave like liars would on Friends, telegraphing their internal states with squirming and darting eyes. This is, to put it mildly, nonsense. Liars don't look away. But Levine's point is that our stubborn belief in some set of nonverbal behaviors associated with deception explains the pattern he finds with his lying tapes. The people we all get right are the ones who match, whose level of truthfulness happens to correspond with the way they look. Blushing Sally matches. She acts like our stereotype of how a liar acts, and she also happens to be lying. That's why we all get her right. In the Friends episode, when Monica finally breaks the news to her brother Ross about her relationship, she takes Ross's hand and says, "I'm so sorry that you had to find out this way. I'm sorry, but it's true. I love him too." We believe her in that moment, that she is genuinely sorry and genuinely in love, because she's perfectly matched. She's being sincere, and she looks sincere. When a liar acts like an honest person, though, or when an honest person acts like a liar, we're flummoxed. Nervous Nelly is mismatched. She looks like she's lying, but she's not. She's just nervous. In other words, human beings are not bad lie detectors. We are bad lie detectors in those situations when the person we're judging is mismatched. At one point in his pursuit of Bernie Madoff, Harry Markopoulos approached a seasoned financial journalist named Michael Okrant. Markopoulos persuaded Okrant to take Madoff seriously as a potential fraud, to the point that Okrant made an appointment to interview Madoff in person. But what happened? It wasn't so much his answers that impressed me, but rather it was his entire demeanor, Okrant said years later. It was almost impossible to sit there with him and believe he was a complete fraud. I remember thinking to myself, if Markopoulos' team is right, and he's running a Ponzi scheme, he's either the best actor I've ever seen or a total sociopath. There wasn't even a hint of guilt or shame or remorse. He was very low-key, almost as if he found the interview amusing. His attitude was sort of, who in their right mind could doubt me? I can't believe people care about this. Madoff was mismatched. He was a liar with the demeanor of an honest man. And Okrant, who knew on an intellectual level that something was not right, was so swayed by meeting Madoff that he dropped the story. Can you blame him? First, there is default to truth, which gives the con artist a head start. But when you add mismatch to that, it's not hard to understand why Madoff fooled so many for so long. And why did so many of the British politicians who met with Hitler misread him so badly? Because Hitler was mismatched as well. Remember Chamberlain's remark about how Hitler greeted him with a double-handed handshake, which Chamberlain believed Hitler reserved for people he liked and trusted? For many of us, a warm and enthusiastic handshake does mean that we feel warm and enthusiastic about the person we're meeting. But not Hitler. He's the dishonest person who acts honest. So what was Amanda Knox's problem? She was mismatched. She's the innocent person who acts guilty. She's Nervous Nelly. Knox, to those who did not know her, was confusing. At the time of the crime, she was 20 and beautiful, with high cheekbones and striking blue eyes. Her nickname was Foxy Noxie. The tabloids got a hold of a list she'd made of all the men she'd slept with. She was the femme fatale, brazen and sexual. The day after her roommate's brutal murder, she was spotted buying red underwear at a lingerie shop with her boyfriend. In fact, the Foxy Noxie nickname had nothing to do with sex.
Sure, I knew Foxy meant sexy or sassy, but that was the irony of it and the fun.
This is Amanda Knox herself reading the audiobook version of her 2013 memoir, Waiting to be Heard.
My soccer girlfriends had ironic and sassy nicknames, too. Martinez was Martini. Miller was Miller Light. Trisha was Trash. By college, when I graduated to Facebook, I seldom looked at MySpace. I could never have dreamed that something so harmless could later have such damning results, that the prosecution would focus on my nickname's other meanings, wily or tricky. Overnight, my old nickname became my new persona. I was now known to the world as Foxy Noxie, or, in Italian, Volpe Cattiva, literally Wicked Fox.
She was buying red underwear a few days after her roommate's murder because her house was a crime scene and she couldn't get access to her clothes. She wasn't a femme fatale. Knox's list of lovers wasn't what it seemed either. In an attempt to intimidate her, the Italian police lied to Knox and told her she was HIV positive. Knox, afraid and alone in her cell, wrote a list of all her past sexual partners to work out how this could possibly be true. She was an immature young woman, only a few years removed from an awkward and pimply adolescence. Brazen and sexual? Amanda Knox was actually a bit of a misfit.
I was the quirky kid who hung out with the sulky manga readers, the ostracized gay kids, and the theater geeks.
In high school, she was the middle-class kid on financial aid, surrounded by well-heeled classmates.
I took Japanese and sang, loudly, in the halls while walking from one class to another. Since I didn't really fit in, I acted like myself, which pretty much made sure I never did.
Matched people conform with our expectations. Their intentions are consistent with their behavior. The mismatched are confusing and unpredictable.
I'd do things that would embarrass most teenagers and adults, walking down the street like an Egyptian or an elephant, but that kids found fall over hilarious. I made myself the butt of jokes to lighten the mood. The people who loved me considered my kookiness endearing. My family and friends would shake their heads good-naturedly and sigh, "That's Amanda."
Kircher's murder in Perugia changed the way their circle of friends behaved. They wept quietly, hushed their voices, murmured their sympathies. But Knox didn't. Just listen to a handful of quotations that I've taken at random from the British journalist John Follain's Death in Perugia. Here is Follain describing what happened when Kircher's friends met up with Knox and Solicito at the police station the day after the murder. "Oh, Amanda, I'm so sorry," Sophie exclaimed, as she instinctively put her arms around her and gave her a bear hug. Amanda didn't hug Sophie back. Instead, she stiffened, holding her arms down by her sides. Amanda said nothing. Surprised, Sophie let go of her after a couple of seconds and stepped back. There was no trace of emotion on Amanda's face. Raffaele walked up to Amanda and took hold of her hand. The couple just stood there, ignoring Sophie and gazing at each other. Believe me, there are many more examples like this. Amanda sat with her feet resting on Raffaele's lap. The two caressed and kissed each other. Sometimes they'd even laugh. "How could Amanda act like that?" Sophie asked herself. "Doesn't she care?" Then how about this? Most of Meredith's friends were in tears or looked devastated, but Amanda and Raffaele made smacking noises with their lips when they kissed or sent kisses to each other. Or how about this? "Let's hope she didn't suffer," Natalie said. "What do you think? They cut her throat, Natalie. She fucking bled to death," Amanda retorted. Amanda's words chilled Natalie. She was surprised both by Amanda talking of several killers and by the coldness of her tone. Natalie thought it was as if Meredith's death didn't concern her. In an interview with Knox, Diane Sawyer of ABC News brought up that last exchange in the police station, where Knox snapped at Kircher's friend and said, "She fucking bled to death."
Yeah. I was angry. I was pacing, thinking about what Meredith must have been through.
Sorry about that now.
I wish I could have been more mature about it. Yeah.
In a situation that typically calls for a sympathetic response, Knox had been loud and angry. Sawyer goes on to say,
"You can see that this does not look like grief. It does not read as grief."
This interview was conducted long after the miscarriage of justice in the Kircher case had become obvious. Knox had just been freed after spending 4 years in an Italian prison for the crime of not behaving the way we think people are supposed to behave after their roommate is murdered. Yet what does Diane Sawyer say to her? She scolds her for not behaving the way we think people are supposed to behave after their roommate is murdered. In the introduction to the interview, the news anchor says that Knox's case remains controversial because, in part, quote, "her pleas for innocence seemed to many people more cold and calculating than remorseful." Which is an even more bizarre thing to say, isn't it? Why would we expect Knox to be remorseful? We expect remorse from the guilty. Knox didn't do anything. But she's still being criticized for being cold and calculating. At every turn, Knox cannot escape censure for her weirdness. As she tells Diane Sawyer,
I think everyone's reaction to something horrible is different.
She's right. Why can't someone be angry in response to a murder rather than sad? If you were Amanda Knox's friend, none of this would surprise you. You would have seen Knox walking down the street like an elephant. But with strangers, we're intolerant of emotional responses that fall outside expectations. While waiting to be interviewed by police, 4 days after Kircher's body was discovered, Knox decided to stretch. She had been sitting, slumped, for hours. She touched her toes, held her arms over her head. The police on duty said to her, "You seem really flexible," Knox recalls.
I replied, "I used to do a lot of yoga." He said, "Can you show me? What else can you do?" I took a few steps toward the elevator and did a split. It felt good to know I still could. While I was on the floor, legs splayed, the elevator doors opened. Rita Ficarra, the cop who had reprimanded Raphael and me about kissing the day before, stepped out. "What are you doing?" she demanded, her voice full of contempt.
The lead investigator in the case, Edgardo Giobbe, says he had doubts about Knox from the moment she walked with him through the crime scene. As she put on protective booties, she swiveled her hips and said, "Ta-da!" "We were able to establish guilt," Giobbe said, "by closely observing the suspect's psychological and behavioral reaction during the interrogation. We don't need to rely on other kinds of investigation." The prosecutor in the case brushed off the mounting criticisms of the way his office had handled the murder. Why did people focus so much on the botched DNA analysis? "Every piece of proof has aspects of uncertainty," he said. To him, the real issue was mismatched Amanda. "I have to remind you that her behavior was completely inexplicable, totally irrational. There's no doubt of this." From Bernard Madoff to Amanda Knox, we do not do well with the mismatched. The most disturbing of Tim Levine's findings was when he showed his lying videotapes to a group of seasoned law enforcement agents, people with 15 years or more of interrogation experience. He had previously used as his judges students and adults from ordinary walks of life. They didn't do well, but perhaps that's to be expected. If you are a real estate agent or a philosophy major, identifying deception in an interrogation isn't necessarily something you do every day. But maybe, Levine thought, people whose job it was to do exactly the kind of thing he was measuring would be better. In one respect, they were. On matched senders, the seasoned interrogators were perfect. You and I would probably come in at 70 or 75% on that set of tapes, but everyone in Levine's group of highly experienced experts got every matched sender right. On mismatched senders, however, their performance was abysmal. They got 20% right. And on the subcategory of sincere acting liars, they came in at 14%, a score so low that it ought to give chills to anyone who ever gets hauled into an interrogation room with an FBI agent. When they are confronted with Blushing Sally, the easy case, they are flawless. When it comes to the Amanda Knoxes and Bernie Madoffs in the world, they are hapless. This is distressing because we don't need law enforcement experts to help us with matched strangers. We're all good at knowing when these kinds of people are misleading us or telling the truth. We need help with mismatched strangers, the difficult cases. A trained interrogator ought to be adept at getting beneath the confusing signals of demeanor, at understanding that when Nervous Nelly overexplains and gets defensive, that's who she is, someone who overexplains and gets defensive. The police officer ought to be the person who sees the quirky, inappropriate girl in a culture far different from her own say, ta-da, and realize she's just a quirky girl in a culture far different from her own. But that's not what we get. Instead, the people charged with making determinations of innocence and guilt seem to be as bad or even worse than the rest of us when it comes to the hardest cases. Is this part of the reason for wrongful convictions? Is the legal system constitutionally incapable of delivering justice to the mismatched? When a judge makes a bail decision and badly underperforms a computer, is this why? Are we sending perfectly harmless people to prison while they await trial simply because they don't look right? We all accept the flaws and inaccuracies of institutional judgment when we believe that those mistakes are random. But Tim Levine's research suggests that they aren't random, that we have built a world that systematically discriminates against a class of people who, through no fault of their own, violate our ridiculous ideas about transparency. The Amanda Knox story deserves to be retold not because it was a once-in-a-lifetime crime saga, a beautiful woman, a picturesque Italian hilltop town, a gruesome murder. It deserves retelling because it happens all the time. Her eyes didn't seem to show any sadness, and I remember wondering if she could have been involved, one of Meredith Kircher's friends told Rolling Stone magazine. Amanda Knox heard years of this, perfect strangers pretending to know who she was based on the expression on her face. There is no trace of me in the room where Meredith was murdered, Knox says at the end of the Amanda Knox documentary. But you're trying to find the answer in my eyes? You're looking at me? Why? These are my eyes. They're not objective evidence. Chapter 8, Case Study, The Fraternity Party. Palo Alto, California, January 18th, 2015, sometime around midnight. Two Swedish graduate students are cycling across the campus of Stanford University on their way to a fraternity party. They see what looks like two people lying on the ground just outside a fraternity house where a party is in full swing. They slow down so as not to disturb the couple. We thought that it was their personal moment, one of the students, Peter Johnson, would say when he testified in court. As they drew closer, they saw that the man was on top, and beneath the man was a young woman, not moving, as they later testified. Johnson and his friend, Carl Friedrich Arndt, got off their bikes and walked closer. Johnson called out, "Hey, is everything all right?" The man on top lifted his body and looked up. Johnson came closer. The man stood up and began backing away. Johnson said, "Hey, what the fuck are you doing? She's unconscious." Johnson said it a second time. "Hey, what the fuck are you doing?" The man began to run. Johnson and his friend gave chase and tackled him. The person Johnson tackled was Brock Turner. He was 19. A freshman at Stanford, and a member of the university's swim team. Less than an hour earlier, he had met a young woman at the Kappa Alpha party. Turner would later tell police that they had danced together, talked, gone outside, and lain down on the ground. The woman was a recent college graduate, known thereafter under the protections of sexual assault law as Emily Doe. She had come to the party with a group of friends. Now she lay motionless under a pine tree next to a dumpster. Her skirt was hiked up around her waist. Her underwear was on the ground next to her. The top of her dress was partially pulled down, revealing one of her breasts. When she came to in the hospital a few hours later that morning, a police officer told her that she may have been sexually assaulted. She was confused. She got up, went to the bathroom, and found that her underwear was gone. It had been taken for evidence. She had to talk through all this later with a prosecutor in court. Because there's no audio, we've asked actors to read from the trial transcript. Every recording you hear from a legal proceeding in this chapter is a reenactment.
What happened after you used the bathroom?
I felt scratching on my neck and realized it was pine needles, and I thought that I may have fallen from a tree because I didn't know why I was there.
Was there a mirror in the bathroom?
Yes.
Could you see your hair in the mirror?
Yes.
Can you describe what your hair, how your hair appeared?
Just disheveled and with little things poking out of it.
Do you have any idea how your hair ended up that way?
No idea.
What did you do after you finished using the restroom?
I went back to the bed, and they gave me a blanket, and I wrapped myself, and I went back to sleep.
Every year around the world, there are countless encounters, just like the one that ended so terribly on the lawn outside the Kappa Alpha fraternity at Stanford University. Two young people, people who do not know each other well, meet and have a conversation. It might be brief or go on for hours. They might go home together, or things may end short of that. But at some point during the evening, things go badly awry. An estimated 1 in 5 American female college students say that they have been the victim of sexual assault. A good percentage of those cases follow this pattern. The challenge in these kinds of cases is reconstructing the encounter. Did both parties consent? Did one party object and the other party ignore that objection or misunderstand it? If the transparency assumption is a problem for police officers making sense of suspects or judges trying to read defendants, then it's clearly going to be an issue for teenagers and young adults navigating one of the most complex of human domains. In a 2015 Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation poll of 1,000 college students, they were asked whether they thought various behaviors established consent for more sexual activity. 50% of men said yes to takes off their own clothes versus 44% of women. To the question, gets a condom, 58% of women said no to 51% of men. Or how about something like nods in agreement? 58% of men take this as a yes versus 51% of women. Only 15% of women believed engages in foreplay such as kissing or touching means some kind of consent. 30% of men believe it does. Consent would be a straightforward matter if all college students agreed that getting a condom meant implicit consent to sex, or if everyone agreed that foreplay, such as kissing or touching, did not constitute an invitation to something more serious. When the rules are clear, each party can easily and accurately infer what the other wants from the way he or she behaves. But what the poll shows is there are no rules. On every issue, there are women who think one way and women who think another, men who think like some women but not others, and a perplexing number of people of both sexes who have no opinion at all. The Washington Post poll found that half of all young men and women are unclear on whether clear agreement is necessary for sexual activity. But does it mean that they haven't thought about it before? Does it mean that they would rather proceed on a case-by-case basis? Does it mean they reserve the right to sometimes proceed without explicit consent and at other times to insist on it? Amanda Knox confounded the legal system because there was a disconnect between the way she acted and the way she felt. But this is transparency failure on steroids. When one college student meets another, even in cases where both have the best of intentions, the task of inferring sexual intent from behavior is essentially a coin flip. As legal scholar Lori Shaw asks, how can we expect students to respect boundaries when no consensus exists as to what they are? There is a second complicating element in many of these encounters, however. When you read through the details of the campus sexual assault cases that have become so depressingly common, the remarkable fact is how many involve an almost identical scenario. A young woman and a young man meet at a party, then proceed to tragically misunderstand each other's intentions, and they're drunk.
What did you drink? I had approximately 5 Rolling Rock beers.
Brock Turner began drinking well before he went to the Kappa Alpha party. He had been at his friend Peter's apartment earlier in the evening. This is a reenactment from the trial transcript of his testimony when questioned by the defense.
Other than the 5 Rolling Rock beers that you've mentioned, did you drink any other alcohol in Peter's room?
Yes, I had some Fireball whiskey.
And how was that consumed?
It was just out of the bottle.
When Turner got to the party, he kept drinking. In California, the legal intoxication limit for drivers is a blood alcohol concentration of 0.08. Anything above that, and you're considered drunk. By the end of the night, Turner's blood alcohol level was twice that. Emily Doe arrived at the party in a group with her sister and her friends Colleen and Tria. Earlier that evening, Tria had consumed an entire bottle of champagne, among other things. There at the party, they were joined by their friend Julia, who had also been drinking, as she later testified.
Did you have anything to drink at dinner?
Yes.
What did you drink?
A full bottle of wine.
What did you do after dinner?
After dinner, I Ubered to a place called Griffin Suite.
And what was going on there at Griffin Suite?
A pregame.
What's that?
Oh, sorry, it's a jargon. It's a pre-party that involves drinking.
After pre-gaming, Julia heads to the Kappa Alpha party, where she discovers an unopened bottle of vodka in the basement. And this is a testimony of Emily Doe when questioned by the prosecution.
And so you started drinking with the shot of whiskey. And then how many? How many drinks did you have before you left your house?
4.
And were they the same type of drink, a shot of whiskey that you had the first time?
I had 4 shots of whiskey and 1 glass of champagne.
Okay, so do you know approximately what time frame this was that you had the 4 shots of whiskey and the 1 glass of champagne?
Probably between 10 and 10:45.
Then she and her friends go on to the party.
Okay, and so after you guys kind of were goofing around, being the welcoming committee, what did you guys do?
Julia discovered a handle of vodka.
Okay. And what is your description of a handle of vodka?
Probably like this big, Costco size.
And what happened when she presented the vodka?
I did a free pour into a red Solo cup.
Okay. Were you measuring in any way how much vodka was in your cup?
I thought I was, but I was unsuccessfully measuring. I poured right below the second marking on the cup, which I thought was going to be 2 to 3 shots. It turned out to be maybe 3 to 4 shots because that marking was 5 ounces.
And you're talking about a red Solo cup?
Yes.
Kind of something that you typically see at parties?
Yes.
Okay. Now, when you were, after you poured the vodka, what did you do?
I drank it.
How did you drink it?
Just for all.
Like all at once?
Pretty much all at once. So I was already feeling drunk because I was able to do that.
How? Describe for us your level of intoxication at this point.
Pretty much empty-minded. I become kind of just a dud and I'm vacant, not articulating much, just standing there.
You have any idea what time this is in the night?
Maybe around midnight.
It was at that point, around midnight, that Brock Turner approached Emily Doe. He says she was dancing alone. He says he approached her and told her he liked the way she danced. He says they chatted. He says he asked her to dance. He says she said yes. He says they danced for 10 minutes. He says they started kissing.
Okay. Did she appear to be responsive to kissing you back?
Yes.
Did you have any further conversation with her that you remember?
Yes, I asked her if she wanted to go back to my dorm.
Okay, and did she respond?
Yes.
What did she say?
She said sure.
Approximately, this would have been after 12:30 then, right?
Yes.
Did you ever learn her name that night?
Yes, I asked her name when we were dancing, but I didn't remember it.
He says he put his arm around her and the two of them left the party. As they walked across the back lawn, he says, the two of them slipped.
She just lost her footing and kind of fell down, and she grabbed onto me to try and prevent her fall, and that caused me to fall as well.
What happened then?
and we laughed about it, and I asked her if she was okay.
Did she respond?
Yeah, she said she thought so.
What happened then?
We started kissing.
Normally, in a sexual assault case, the prosecution would present witnesses to raise questions about the defendant's account. But that didn't happen in People versus Brock Turner. By that point, Tria had become so drunk that Emily's sister and her friend Colleen had taken her back to Julia's dorm room. Turner's friend Peter never made it to the party at all. He was too drunk and had to be taken back to his dorm by two of Turner's other friends. Presumably, there might have been other people at the party who could corroborate or refute Turner's story, but by this point, it was after midnight, the lights had been lowered, and people were dancing on the tables. So we only have Turner's account.
What happened then?
We kissed for a little bit after that, and then I asked her if she wanted me to finger her.
Did she reply to you?
Yes.
What did she say?
She said yeah.
After you obtained her concurrence or permission to finger her, and you did finger her, what happened then?
I fingered her for a minute, and I thought she had an orgasm, and then during that time I asked her if she liked it, and she said, uh-huh.
And then after that, what did you do?
I started kissing with her again, and then we started dry-humping each other.
Under California law, someone is incapable of giving consent to sexual activity if they are either unconscious or so intoxicated that they are, quote, prevented from resisting. Here is what the legal scholar Laurie Shaw writes about the law. It is not enough that the victim was intoxicated to some degree, or that the intoxication reduced the victim's sexual inhibitions. Instead, the level of intoxication and the resulting mental impairment must have been so great that the victim could no longer exercise reasonable judgment concerning that issue. As one California prosecutor explained, the intoxicated victim must be so out of it that she does not understand what she is doing or what is going on around her. It is not a situation where the victim just had too much to drink. So, was Emily Doe a willing participant at the time of the sexual activity and passed out afterward? Or was she already incapable of consent at the time Turner put his finger inside her? People versus Brock Turner is a case about alcohol. The entire case turned on the degree of Emily Doe's drunkenness. In the end, the jury ruled against Turner. His version of events was simply unconvincing. If, as Turner suggests, they had a warm, consensual encounter, why did he run the moment he was challenged by the two grad students? Why was he dry-humping her after she had passed out? Just after midnight, Doe left a voicemail for her boyfriend. The tape of that conversation was played for the jury. She's barely coherent. If the legal standard is so out of it that she does not understand what she's doing, then she sounded pretty close to that. During the trial's closing arguments, the prosecutor showed the jury a picture of Doe taken as she lay on the ground. Her clothes are half off. Her hair is disheveled. She's lying on a bed of pine needles. A dumpster is in the background. No self-respecting woman who knows what's going on wants to get penetrated right there, the prosecutor said. This photo alone can tell you that he took advantage of someone who didn't know what was going on. Turner was convicted of 3 felony counts associated with the illegal use of his finger. Assault with intent to commit rape of an intoxicated or unconscious person, sexual penetration of an intoxicated person, and sexual penetration of an unconscious person. He was sentenced to 6 months in prison and must register as a sex offender for the rest of his life. The who of the Brock Turner case was never in doubt. The what was determined by the jury, but that still leaves the why. Why did an apparently harmless encounter on a dance floor end in a crime? We know that our mistaken belief that people are transparent leads to all manner of problems between strangers. It leads us to confuse the innocent with the guilty and the guilty with the innocent. Under the best of circumstances, lack of transparency makes the encounter between a man and a woman at a party a problematic event. So what happens when alcohol is added to the mix? Dwight Heath was a graduate student in anthropology at Yale University in the mid-1950s when he decided to do the field work for his dissertation in Bolivia. He and his wife, Anna Heath, flew to Lima with their baby boy, then waited 5 hours while mechanics put boosters on the plane's engines. These were planes that the U.S. had dumped after World War II, Heath recalls. They weren't supposed to go above 10,000 feet, but La Paz, where we were headed, was at 12,000 feet. As they flew into the Andes, Anna Heath says, they looked down and saw the remnants of all the planes where the boosters didn't work. From La Paz, they traveled 500 miles into the interior of eastern Bolivia to a small frontier town called Montero. It was the part of Bolivia where the Amazon basin meets the Chaco region, vast stretches of jungle and lush prairie. The area was inhabited by the Camba, a mestizo people descended from the indigenous Indian populations and Spanish settlers. The Camba spoke a language that was a mixture of the local Indian languages and 17th century Andalusian Spanish. It was an empty spot on the map, Heath remembers. There was a railroad coming, there was a highway coming, there was a national government coming. They lived in a tiny house just outside of town. There was no pavement, no sidewalks, Anna Heath says. If there was meat in town, they'd throw out the hide in front so you'd know where it was. And you would bring banana leaves in your hand, so it was your dish. There were adobe houses with stucco and tile roofs, and the town plaza with 3 palm trees. You heard the rumble of ox carts. The padres had a jeep. Some of the women would serve a big pot of rice and some sauce. That was the restaurant. The guy who did the coffee was German. The year we came to Bolivia, a grand total of 85 foreigners visited the country. It wasn't exactly a hotspot. In Montero, the Heaths engaged in old-fashioned ethnography, vacuuming up everything, Dwight says, learning everything. They convinced the Camba that they weren't missionaries by openly smoking cigarettes. They took thousands of photographs. They walked around the town and talked to whomever they could. Then Dwight went home and spent the night typing up his notes. After a year and a half, the Heaths packed up their photographs and notes and returned to New Haven. There, Dwight Heath sat down to write his dissertation, only to discover that he had nearly missed what was perhaps the most fascinating fact about the community he had been studying. "Do you realize," he told his wife as he looked over his notes, "that every weekend we were in Bolivia, we went out drinking? Every Saturday night, the entire time they were there, the Heaths were invited to drinking parties. The host would buy the first bottle and issue the invitations. A dozen or so people would show up, and the party would proceed, often until everyone went back to work on Monday morning. The composition of the group was informal. Sometimes people passing by would be invited, but the structure of the party was heavily ritualized. The group sat in a circle. Someone might play the drums or a guitar. A bottle of rum from one of the sugar refineries in the area and a small drinking glass were placed on a table. The host stood, filled the glass with rum, then walked towards someone in the circle. He stood before the toastee, nodded, and raised the glass. The toastee smiled and nodded in return. The host then drank half the glass and handed it to the toastee, who finished it. The toastee eventually stood, refilled the glass, and repeated the ritual with someone else in the circle. When people got too tired or too drunk, they curled up on the ground and passed out, rejoining the party when they awoke. "The alcohol they drank was awful," Anna recalled. "Literally, your eyes poured tears. The first time I had it, I thought, I wonder what will happen if I just vomit in the middle of the floor." Not even the Camba said they liked it. "They say it tastes bad, it burns. The next day, they're sweating this stuff. You can smell it." The anthropology graduate student in the 1950s felt that he had to adapt, Dwight said. "You don't want to offend anyone. You don't want to decline anything. I gritted my teeth and accepted those drinks." "We didn't get drunk that much," Anna went on, "because we didn't get toasted as much as the other folks around. We were strangers. But one night, there was this really big party, 60 to 80 people. They'd drink, then pass out, then wake up and party for a while, and I found, in their drinking patterns, that I could turn my drink over to Dwight. The husband is obliged to drink for his wife. And Dwight is holding a Coleman lantern with his arm wrapped around it, and I said, "Dwight, you're burning your arm." She mimed her husband peeling his forearm off the hot surface of the lantern, and he said, very deliberately, "So I am." When the Heaths came back to New Haven, they had a bottle of the Cambas rum analyzed and learned that it was 180 proof. It was the same as laboratory alcohol, the concentration that scientists use to preserve tissue. No one drinks laboratory alcohol. This was the first of the astonishing findings of the Heath research, and, predictably, no one believed it at first. One of the world's leading physiologists of alcohol was at the Yale Center, Heath recalled. His name was Leon Greenberg. He said to me, "Hey, you spin a good yarn, but you couldn't really have drunk that stuff." And he needled me just enough that he knew he would get a response. So I said, "You want me to drink it? I have a bottle." So one Saturday, I drank some under controlled conditions. He was taking blood samples every 20 minutes, and sure enough, I did drink it just the way I said I'd drunk it. Greenberg had an ambulance ready to take Heath home, but Heath decided to walk. Anna was waiting up for him in the third-floor walk-up they rented in an old fraternity house. I was hanging out the window waiting for him, and there is the ambulance driving along the street, very slowly, and next to it is Dwight. He waves, and he looks fine. Then he walks up the three flights of stairs and says, "Oh, I'm drunk," and falls flat in his face. He was out for 3 hours. Here we have a community of people in a poor and undeveloped part of the world who hold drinking parties with 180 proof alcohol every weekend, from Saturday night until Monday morning. The Camba must have paid dearly for their excesses, right? Wrong. There was no social pathology. None, Dwight Heath said. No arguments, no disputes, no sexual aggression, no verbal aggression. There was pleasant conversation or silence. He went on, "The drinking didn't interfere with work, it didn't bring in the police, and there was no alcoholism either." Heath wrote up his findings in a now-famous article for the Quarterly Journal of Studies on Alcohol. In the years that followed, countless other anthropologists chimed in to report the same thing. Alcohol sometimes led people to raise their voices and fight and say things they would otherwise regret, but a lot of other times it didn't. The Aztec called pulque, the traditional alcoholic beverage of Central Mexico, 400 rabbits because of the seemingly infinite variety of behaviors it could create. Anthropologist Mac Marshall traveled to the South Pacific island of Truk and found that, for young men there, drunkenness created aggression and mayhem. But once the islanders reached their mid-30s, it had the opposite effect. In Oaxaca, Mexico, the Mije Indians were known to engage in wild fistfights when drunk. But when anthropologist Ralph Beals started watching the fights, they didn't seem out of control at all. They seemed as though they were all following the same script. Although I probably saw several hundred fights, I saw no weapons used, although nearly all men carried machetes and many carried rifles, he writes. Most fights start with a drunken quarrel. When the pitch of voices reaches a certain point, everyone expects a fight. The men hold out their weapons to the onlookers and then begin to fight with their fists, swinging wildly until one falls down, at which point the victor helps his opponent to his feet, and usually they embrace each other. None of this makes sense. Alcohol is a powerful drug. It disinhibits. It breaks down the set of constraints that hold our behavior in check. That's why it doesn't seem surprising that drunkenness is so overwhelmingly linked with violence, car accidents, and sexual assault. But if the Camba's drinking bouts had so few social side effects, and if the Mije Indians of Mexico seemed to be following a script even during their drunken brawls, then our perception of alcohol as a disinhibiting agent can't be right. It must be something else. Dwight and Anna Heath's experience in Bolivia set in motion a complete rethinking of our understanding of intoxication. Many of those who study alcohol no longer consider it as an agent of disinhibition. They think of it as an agent of myopia. The myopia theory was first suggested by psychologists Claude Steele and Robert Josephs. And what they mean by myopia is that alcohol's principal effect is to narrow our emotional and mental fields of vision. It creates, in their words, a state of short-sightedness in which superficially understood, immediate aspects of experience have a disproportionate influence on behavior and emotion. Alcohol makes the thing in the foreground even more salient, and the thing in the background less significant. It makes short-term considerations loom large, and more cognitively demanding longer-term considerations fade away. Here's an example. Lots of people drink when they're feeling down because they think it will chase their troubles away. That's inhibition thinking. Alcohol will unlock my good mood. But that's plainly not what happens. Sometimes alcohol cheers us up, but at other times, when an anxious person drinks, they just get more anxious. Myopia theory has an answer to that puzzle. It depends on what the anxious drunk person is doing. If he's at a football game surrounded by rabid fans, the excitement and drama going on around him will temporarily crowd out his pressing worldly concerns. The game is front and center. His worries are not. But if the same man is in a quiet corner of a bar, drinking alone, he'll get even more depressed. Now there's nothing to distract him. Drinking puts you at the mercy of your environment. It crowds out everything except the most immediate experiences. So, suppose that you're a successful professional comedian. The world thinks you are very funny. You think you're very funny. If you get drunk, you won't think of yourself as even funnier. There's no conflict over your hilariousness that alcohol can resolve. But suppose you think you're very funny, and the world generally doesn't. In fact, whenever you try to entertain a group with a funny story, a friend pulls you aside the next morning and gently discourages you from ever doing it again. Under normal circumstances, the thought of that awkward conversation with your friend keeps you in check. But when you're drunk, the alcohol makes the conflict go away. You no longer think about the future corrective feedback regarding your bad jokes. Now it is possible for you to believe that you actually are funny. When you're drunk, your understanding of your true self changes. This is the crucial implication of drunkenness as myopia. The old disinhibition idea implied that what was revealed when someone got drunk was a kind of stripped-down, distilled version of their sober self, without any of the muddying effects of social nicety and propriety. You got the real you. As the ancient saying goes, in vino veritas, in wine there is truth. But that's backwards. The kinds of conflicts that normally keep our impulses in check are a crucial part of how we form our character. All of us construct our personality by managing the conflict between immediate, near considerations and more complicated, longer-term considerations. That is what it means to be ethical or productive or responsible. The good parent is someone who is willing to temper their own immediate selfish needs to be left alone, to be allowed to sleep, with longer-term goals to raise a good child. When alcohol peels away those longer-term constraints on our behavior, it obliterates our true self. So, who were the Kamba in reality? He says their society was marked by a singular lack of communal expression. They were itinerant farm workers. Kinship ties were weak. Their daily labor tended to be solitary, the hours long. There were few neighborhood or civic groups. The daily demands of their lives made socializing difficult. So on the weekends, they used the transformative power of alcohol to create the communal expression so sorely lacking from Monday to Friday. They used the myopia of alcohol to temporarily create a different world for themselves. They gave themselves strict rules, one bottle at a time, an organized series of toasts, all seated around the circle, only on the weekends, never alone. They drank only within a structure, and the structure of those drinking circles in the Bolivian interior was a world of soft music and quiet conversation, order, friendship, predictability, and ritual. This was a new Camba society, manufactured with the assistance of one of the most powerful drugs on earth. Alcohol isn't an agent of revelation. It's an agent of transformation. In 2006, the United Kingdom had its own version of the Brock Turner trial, a high-profile case involving a 25-year-old software designer named Benjamin Bree and a woman identified by the court only as M. It is a textbook example of the complications created by alcohol myopia. The two met for the first time at Bree's brother's apartment and went out that same night. Over the course of the evening, M had 2 pints of cider and between 4 and 6 drinks of vodka mixed with Red Bull. Bree, who had been drinking earlier in the day, matched her round for round. Footage from closed-circuit cameras showed the two of them walking back to her apartment arm-in-arm around 1 in the morning. They had sex. Bree thought it was consensual. M said it wasn't. He was convicted of rape and sentenced to 5 years in prison, only to have the verdict thrown out on appeal. If you have read any other accounts of these kinds of cases, the details will be depressingly familiar. Pain, regret, misunderstanding, and anger. Here is an actor reading the testimony of Bree as he described his side of the story.
I was hoping to avoid sleeping on the floor and thought that maybe I could share her bed, which in hindsight seems such a stupid thing to do. I wasn't looking for sex, just a mattress and some human company. She woke up and I lay down next to her and eventually we started hugging and then kissing. It was a bit unexpected, but nice. We were indulging in foreplay for about 30 minutes, and it sounded like she was enjoying it.
And then, from the court's decision, he insisted that M appeared to welcome his advances, which progressed from stroking of a comforting nature to sexual touching. She said and did nothing to stop him. He told the jury that one needed to be sure about consent, which is why he stroked her for so long. The complainant could not gainsay that this foreplay lasted for some time. Eventually, he put the top of his fingers inside the waistband of her pajama trousers, which would have given her an opportunity to discourage him. She did not. She seemed particularly responsive when he put his hand inside her pajama trousers. After sexual touching, he motioned for her to remove the pajama trousers. He pulled them down slightly, then she removed them altogether. Bree thought he could infer M's inner state from her behavior. He assumed she was transparent. She wasn't. Here, from the court's filings, is how M was actually feeling. She had no idea how long intercourse lasted. When it ended, she was still facing the wall. She did not know whether the appellant had in fact used a condom or not, nor whether he ejaculated or not. Afterwards, he asked if she wanted him to stay. She said no. In her mind, she thought, "Get out of my room," although she did not actually say it. She did not know, quote, what to say or think, whether he would turn and beat me. I remember him leaving, the door shutting. She got up and locked the door and then returned to lie in her bed, curled up in a ball, but she could not remember for how long. At 5 a.m., M called her best friend in tears. Bree, meanwhile, was still so oblivious to her inner state that he knocked on M's door a few hours later and asked M if she wanted to go to get fish and chips for lunch. After several months in prison, Bree was freed when an appeals court concluded that it was impossible to figure out what the two of them did or did not consent to in M's bedroom that night. Both were adults, the judge wrote. Neither acted unlawfully in drinking to excess. They were both free to choose how much to drink and with whom. Both were free, if they wished, to have intercourse with each other. There is nothing abnormal, surprising, or even unusual about men and women having consensual intercourse when one or the other, or both, have voluntarily consumed a great deal of alcohol. The practical reality is that there are some areas of human behavior which are inapt for detailed legislative structures. You may or may not agree with that final ruling, but it is hard to disagree with the judge's fundamental complaint that adding alcohol to the process of understanding another's intentions makes a hard problem downright impossible. Alcohol is a drug that reshapes the drinker according to the contours of his immediate environment. In the case of the Kamba, that reshaping of personality and behavior was benign. Their immediate environment was carefully and deliberately constructed. They wanted to use alcohol to create a temporary, and in their minds better, version of themselves. But when young people today drink to excess, they aren't doing so in a ritualized, predictable environment carefully constructed to create a better version of themselves. They're doing so in the hyper-sexualized chaos of fraternity parties and bars.
What was your observation that you've made of the kind of atmosphere that existed at parties at Kappa Alpha before?
A lot of grinding and...
What do you mean by grinding?
Girls dancing, facing away from a guy, and the guy behind them dancing with them.
All right. So you're describing a position where are you both facing in the same direction?
Yes.
But the boy's behind the girl?
Yes.
And how close are their bodies during this grinding dancing?
They're touching.
Is that common at these parties that you noticed?
Yes.
Did people dance on tables? Was that a common thing too?
Yes.
Consent is something that two parties negotiate on the assumption that each side in a negotiation is who they say they are. But how can you determine consent when, at the moment of negotiation, both parties are so far from their true selves? What happens to us when we get drunk is a function of the particular path the alcohol takes as it seeps through our brain tissue. The effects begin in the frontal lobes, the part of our brain behind our forehead that governs attention, motivation, planning, and learning. The first drink dampens activity in that region. It makes us a little dumber, less capable of handling competing, complicated considerations. It hits the reward centers of the brain, the areas that govern euphoria, and gives them a little jolt. It finds its way into the amygdala. The amygdala's job is to tell us how to react to the world around us. Are we being threatened? Should we be afraid? Alcohol turns the amygdala down a notch. The combination of these three effects is where myopia comes from. We don't have the brain power to handle more complex, long-term considerations. We're distracted by the unexpected pleasure of the alcohol. Our neurological burglar alarm is turned off. We become altered versions of ourselves, beholden to the moment. Alcohol also finds its way to your cerebellum at the very back of your brain, which is involved in balance and coordination. That's why you start to stumble and stagger when intoxicated. These are the predictable effects of getting drunk. But under certain very particular circumstances, especially if you drink a lot of alcohol very quickly, something else happens. Alcohol hits the hippocampus, small sausage-like regions on each side of the brain that are responsible for forming memories about our lives. At a blood alcohol level of roughly 0.08, the legal level of intoxication, the hippocampus starts to struggle. When you wake up the morning after a cocktail party and remember meeting someone but cannot for the life of you remember their name or the story they told you, that's because the two shots of whiskey you drank in quick succession reached your hippocampus. Drink a little more, and the gaps get larger, to the point where maybe you remember pieces of the evening, but other details can be summoned only with the greatest of difficulty.
The hippocampus doesn't seem to be selective about what it records. You might have the most traumatic evening of your life, and what you remember is brushing your teeth.
That's Aaron White of the National Institutes of Health outside Washington, D.C. He's one of the world's leading experts on blackouts, and he says there is no particular logic to which bits get remembered and which don't.
Emotional salience doesn't seem to have an impact on the likelihood that your hippocampus records something. So, you know, and what that means is you might, as a female, you might go to a party and you might remember having a drink downstairs, but you don't remember getting raped. But then you do remember getting in the taxi.
That's frightening enough. But consider that roughly around a blood alcohol level of 0.15, the hippocampus simply shuts down entirely.